presents First Years, a podcast for all but geared toward adult first-time readers of Harry Potter, who need a space to enjoy each book and have adult conversations about it. My name is Sarah, and I'm honored that you've allowed me on this journey with you. Crack open a butterbeer, grab a seat, and let's discuss. Today, we're talking about Percy's letter and the Hogwarts High Inquisitor. Welcome, everybody, to episode 53 of First Years. Today, we're talking about chapters 14 and 15 of Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. We have some house points updates. So Hufflepuff has 520 points now. Slytherin has 190. Ravenclaw has 180. And Gryffindor has 155. It's getting pretty close, guys, between whoever's going to take second place. Hufflepuff has been going strong since the beginning of the podcast, so it's going to take a lot of effort to take them down, if that's something you're interested in. But we have a lot of new faces in Ravenclaw and Gryffindor, and you guys are starting to give Slytherins a run for their money, which is very exciting. As a reminder, you can earn house points by participating in our Mindful Magic Mondays on our Instagram at First Years Pod, answering trivia questions in our stories, that's usually on Wednesdays, and by rating and reviewing the podcast and leaving your name and Hogwarts house, I'll give you a shout out on here and you'll earn extra house points. We left off last episode with Harry being frustrated that he couldn't write to Sirius about everything that was going on after his detention with Umbridge and his scar hurting. And we pick up in chapter 14 where Harry decides to write him anyway, but he finds that it's actually pretty hard to write what he wants to say without explicitly saying it. He comes up with a very clever way to code his message and heads off to send it, but it's actually a pretty eventful task. Harry runs into Cho in the Owlry just after he sends the letter off with Hedwig. He also sees one of those winged horses from his arrival at the school again, flying above the forest. Harry and Cho finally get a third try at conversation, and third time's the charm, I guess, with these two. Filch does interrupt, but nothing necessarily embarrassing happens like the first two times, besides, you know, two people being kind of awkward around each other. She says that he was brave for standing up to Umbridge. Then when Filch interrupts him, he says that someone tipped him off that Harry was sending an order for dung bombs. And he orders Harry to hand over whatever he was going to send, but it's gone. And Cho backs him up, saying, "The letter's already gone." When the Daily Prophet arrives, there's two interesting pieces of news we get. The first is that there was a tip-off that Sirius is hiding in London, and Harry automatically assumes Lucius Malfoy probably gave the tip because Draco implied that he knew it was Sirius on the platform. So all of Kingsley Shacklebolt's hard work just went up in smoke, I bet, which really sucks. The other piece of news is that Sturgis Podmore was arrested for trespass and attempted robbery. Someone caught him trying to get through a high security door at 1 a.m. He was sentenced to 6 months in Azkaban. And there's a bunch of speculation about what he could be doing. Could it be that the ministry was trying to frame him because he's close to Dumbledore? Why didn't he show up as part of the guard to go to King's Cross? Why was he there so late at night? What do you guys think? This also confirms what we've spoken about in regard to Azkaban before. There's no other jail for minor crimes. This proves that you get sent there and go through the same punishment that the worst of the worst do. Do you think that's fair, knowing the effect the Dementors have on people? Or do you think it's fine? I'm interested to hear your thoughts on that as well. After this, we head to Quidditch practice, first with just Harry and Ron, so Ron can get a warm-up before the real practice starts, and then for the real one. But although the first part goes well, the second part, of course, doesn't go according to plan. The Slytherins decide to show up and make fun of Ron during his first ever practice, which is just awful and cruel, and they completely get to Ron's head. And while Fred and George usually might poke fun at someone, especially a brother, like we see them do as everyone's getting changed, they don't make fun of him in this moment, which I think is important to point out because they're his family and they know him really well. And they know where the line is and when not to cross it and make things worse. Not to mention that anything Fred and George would say would probably be in good fun, although possibly annoying, and nothing horrible and cruel like Draco and everybody else decides to say. I feel terrible for Ron here. There's a lot of pressure to live up to, not just because he doesn't want to embarrass himself in front of Harry or his brothers, but Oliver Wood was an excellent keeper. And there's a lot weighing on the shoulders of a keeper. Besides the Seeker, you're the last line of defense to keep the score low so you can win. And who hasn't been in the position of being so nervous that while you would probably do really well at something, you're so nervous you screw things up? I've certainly been in that position, and I would assume you have too. The entire practice is a mess. Katie's nosebleed gets worse because Fred and George gave her the wrong side of a skiving snack box, and so they end practice, and Ron's really upset about it, to the point where he snaps at Hermione and can't focus on homework. So they're swamped the next day. Toward the end of the evening, Percy's owl, Hermes, appears with a letter to Ron. It's an odd moment because we know about the divide in the Weasley family with Percy, and now he's actively reaching out to Ron. And then once we read the letter, it's not that surprising as to why he's reached out. And it's so self-serving. He congratulates Ron on following in quote-unquote his footsteps instead of Fred and George's. He writes, quote, "From something the minister let slip when telling me you are now a prefect, I gather you are still seeing a lot of Harry Potter." Unquote. What kind of a sentence is this? Harry is Ron's best friend. Of course he is still seeing a lot of him. Why would Percy expect any different? It's so infuriating. And that by being around Harry, he's in danger of losing the badge, as if that's all Ron is concerned about. It seems like Percy doesn't know his brother at all. He's kind of projecting onto Ron what Percy would do in Ron's shoes, which is drop Harry as a friend at once and prioritize a badge at school instead of valuing one's closest friend. And it just gets worse. He claims Harry got off on a technicality and that Harry is unbalanced and that Ron might be nervous to cut ties with him and speculates that Harry might be violent. And he tells him to go to Umbridge if he's worried about anything. He's warning that Dumbledore probably won't be in charge of Hogwarts that much longer, which is a terrifying thought. We hear that Umbridge is getting very little cooperation from staff, and that Ron should be loyal to the ministry, and if he's helpful to Umbridge, he'll be head boy. Again, assuming Ron wants the role. And he says that it pains him to criticize their parents, but I kind of feel like that's not true. It doesn't feel that difficult for Percy to have done what he did, especially since he's telling Ron to do the same thing. And he writes, quote, "I shall, of course, be ready to accept a full apology when that day comes." Unquote. The whole note makes my skin crawl to read it, especially since we know he is wrong about everything and that Harry isn't unbalanced or violent and that Voldemort is back and the ministry doesn't have the correct story at all. Is there a way to see things in Percy's view at all here? Does he deserve that kind of empathy? Or no? I think I can fully understand the motivations and wanting to go after the position you want, but I don't understand and cannot defend the giving up of friends for such positions and the breaking up of family for such things either. Yes, go after your goals. And of course, there will be situations in which you might have to let go of people who are no longer a positive influence in your life. But I'm not sure I can see that applying to this situation for Percy. Perhaps I'm biased because I know the truth about the Voldemort situation and Harry is our main character and Ron is his best friend, but I really don't see how that's defensible. What do you guys think? As an actor and writer, I like to understand character motivations. And if I really try, Percy is so blinded by his desire for what he wants and is so quick to believe the good of the ministry that he throws his loyalty at it without question. And that makes sense logistically, but I think at the same time doesn't make him a good person. And it says a lot about his character and his priorities. And I love Ron's reaction. He just rips the letter to shreds. And Harry reflects on this letter. We spoke about how it was Percy's behavior in the hearing that convinced Harry to speak up and make his case. Percy is someone that isn't a stranger to Harry, and it finally hits Harry in that moment. He says, quote, "There was something about seeing it written down like that in Percy's writing that made his situation real to him as nothing else had. He had known Percy for 4 years, had stayed in his house during the summers, shared a tent with him during the Quidditch World Cup, had even been awarded full marks by him in the second task of the Triwizard Tournament last year. Yet now, Percy thought him unbalanced and possibly violent," unquote. Then he says, quote, "And with a surge of sympathy for his godfather, Harry thought that Sirius was probably the only person he knew who could really understand how he felt at this moment, because Sirius was in the same situation. Nearly everyone in the wizarding world thought Sirius a dangerous murderer and a great Voldemort supporter, and he had to live with that knowledge for 14 years, unquote. That's a huge revelation for Harry, and he's right. Sirius has been in a similar situation where no one really knows the truth of what happened. The ministry has been spreading the story about Sirius killing 12 people for years and threw him in jail without a trial. One of the differences, though, at least in this moment right here, is that most people who believe this about Sirius don't actually know him. Yes, Lupin thought Sirius did it, but once they were able to talk and figure it all out, Lupin forgave Sirius immediately. They even admitted that they were suspicious of one another at the time during the first Wizarding War. Here, Percy, who knows Harry relatively well and has spent enough time around him to know that he isn't a violent individual, has completely jumped ship against Harry. And my question is, what does that mean? How can that happen? What do you think finally convinced Percy that Harry is not to be believed? What kind of information can just convince a person of something that the evidence doesn't demonstrate? And the outlook of the ministry is pretty crazy, which we find out when Sirius appears in the fire to answer Harry's letter. Sirius is pretty convinced that Umbridge probably isn't a Death Eater, and we find out that she, again, is even worse than we originally thought. We already knew how she felt about quote-unquote half-breeds, but she actually passed legislation to make it almost impossible for werewolves to get jobs, which is horrific. And we don't know the process of how to get legislation passed, but the fact that she was able to do it shows us a lot about the ministry, too. And we find out why her class is only based in theory. The ministry doesn't want students trained in combat because they're worried that Dumbledore is forming his own army. Which is, what was your reaction to reading that? Fudge thinks Dumbledore is so set on seizing power from him that he's going to build an army of students to fight against the ministry. And Sirius says, quote, "It's a matter of time before he has Dumbledore arrested on some trumped up charge," unquote. Can anyone smell corruption and overstepping one's power? Because if Fudge is just going to make up a charge, or make worse a small charge of some kind, just to get Dumbledore out of the way, it gives me zero faith in the ministry. And it says a lot about Fudge, that he is so power hungry to hold his position that he isn't thinking straight. It just makes me wonder about how he feels about other wizards who might want to be minister, not just Dumbledore. Would he be going up against them just as hard too? We also find out that Hagrid was supposed to be back by now, but he and Madame Maxime got separated, and so no one really knows where he is or how he's doing, but Dumbledore isn't worried. And then, just like the Quidditch practice, the visit from Sirius ends badly. Sirius wants to come visit again, and Harry insists that he doesn't. He's trying to be safe about it, but Sirius, seemingly out of nowhere, says that Harry is less like his father than he thought, and that the risk would have made it fun for James. And that feels like a very low blow. And I wonder if it's because Sirius is home alone and can't go outside that often. I mean, that's bound to drive anybody crazy, but I do think it's unfair for him to get so offended and take that out on Harry and say what he said. Sirius is the first real guardian that Harry has that he trusts and feels like he can be open with. And yet Sirius is making him feel bad for not wanting to meet up, even though Harry is saying no because he has his best interests at heart. What do you think about this moment? In the next chapter, we find out about what Percy was talking about. Umbridge is appointed as the first ever High Inquisitor of Hogwarts, which, according to the newspaper, gives the ministry, quote, unprecedented levels of control at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, unquote. And that's not the only thing we learn. We learn that there have been some parents that have vocalized their disapproval of the direction Hogwarts is heading, and that Fudge has been creating new laws a lot recently, like Educational Decree 22, which allows the ministry to provide a candidate to Hogwarts if the headmaster is unable to find one. This is how Umbridge was able to get her position as Defense Against the Dark Arts professor. And now with Educational Decree 23, Umbridge can inspect other teachers and make sure everything is up to ministry standards, whatever that means. And of course, the one parent quoted was Lucius Malfoy, who we know has money to prevent and pass new laws. And perhaps, do we think this is part of Voldemort's plan? Like, infiltrate the ministry like this and ensure falling standards at Hogwarts? Because it doesn't seem like Umbridge actually wants to improve the school, since she doesn't want students practicing practical magic. It's very bizarre. And in the article, it talks about two Wizengamot elders who resigned in protest. They say that, quote, "Hogwarts is a school, not an outpost of Cornelius Fudge's office. This is a further disgusting attempt to discredit Albus Dumbledore," unquote. And then in the paper, it says, quote, "For a full account of Madame Marchbanks's alleged links to subversive goblin groups, turn to page 17, unquote. It's so sleazy, and it's not a mistake. I'm sure that Madame Marchbanks probably doesn't have ties to goblin groups, and they're just saying that to mislead people and discredit her because she's on Dumbledore's side. And we're seeing similar things today of parents wanting control over how their children's education is run and what topics they learn about. And I think it can get really tricky. Because while some might want their children to learn about a wide variety of topics and really have an in-depth education, which is beneficial for students, others might want certain topics avoided, and that ultimately harms students in the long run. And we've seen many a resignation protest in our own governments before when a move has been made. So let's reevaluate. I asked earlier in this book if you thought Fudge was overstepping boundaries in his office when he was looking for people who were close to Dumbledore and would get rid of them. Do you think he's overstepping now, either again or for the first time? Do you think that this move is okay? What do you think about the Daily Prophet adding in that little poke at Madame Marchbanks? We don't have to wait long to see Umbridge in action. We hear about her in Charms class from Fred and George, and then we see her firsthand in Divination class. Professor Trelawney is not very happy to see her. She scopes out the class, follows Trelawney around, and then asks her questions. We find out that Trelawney has been teaching for 16 years, and she's the great-great-granddaughter of a celebrated seer named Cassandra. And she asks Trelawney to predict something for her. So we've kind of known that Trelawney probably isn't really a good psychic or anything. She's constantly getting things wrong. And yet she's had a vision before in front of Harry in book 3, and that seemed to be a real one. And so it does seem pretty true that the inner eye doesn't see upon command, like she tells Umbridge. Yet I would think that even if she couldn't have a vision or anything in front of Umbridge, couldn't she try interpreting a dream or read her tea leaves or use a crystal ball? Something other than faking a vision in front of the class? What do you think? I think I understand her anger because she is put under pressure, and for Umbridge to expect predictions to come on command is pretty crazy. But perhaps Trelawney also feels called out, like everyone thinks she's a fake, and so now someone is trying to catch her out of it and it's putting her on the defensive. What do you think? Do you care? Do you not care? Trelawney is kind of one of those people that we see semi-often in these books, but we don't really like. But she's not as bad as Snape, but we don't look forward to seeing her like we do Hagrid. After the class, we get another Defense Against the Dark Arts lesson, and Hermione has read the entire book, and she offers up her opinion on Slinkard's opinion on counter jinxes. Yet Umbridge isn't having any of it. She says that Slinkard's opinion is what matters, not Hermione's, and that the ministry-approved method, quote, does not include inviting students to give their opinions on matters about which they understand very little, unquote. Which is like the whole point of the class, no? Like, yes, I feel like in certain classes in high school, your job is to just remember the information and recite it back on the exam. But at the same time, there are a lot of classes where your opinion matters. Like every essay you write is based in an argument where you put your own opinion in on the matter. That's what gives students an opportunity to critically think about a topic. It's an essential part of learning, so you don't just take everything at face value. Yet in this class, we're supposed to take Slinkard's word as law and not have our own opinions on it because we aren't experts in the field yet, supposedly. Umbridge says that none of her predecessors would have passed an inspection except for Quirrell. And Harry jumps in that the only thing wrong with him was that Voldemort was on the back of his head and lands himself in another week of detention. And we get another discussion about Harry's temper. I'm doing air quotes. Every time I see the word, I groan. Angelina makes a big scene regarding Harry being put in detention and missing Quidditch again, and McGonagall notices, and she says, quote, "Are you telling me that after the warning I gave you last Monday, you lost your temper in Professor Umbridge's class again?" Unquote. And then she takes points from Gryffindor, and when Harry asks her why, she says it's because detention apparently doesn't have an effect on him. She's trying to fix this situation with more punishment, But in reality, Harry just needs care and someone to talk to freely about what he's going through. Instead, he's just expected to take it and have the emotional control that an adult has if they were going through this situation, which is a big ask for someone who is 15. And Hermione agrees with McGonagall on this. And Harry doesn't speak to her through class, and I can't blame him. But also, I think that proves my point. It just makes Harry angrier, and he needs people on his side, which Hermione is, but I think it's also unfair for her to expect him to keep control of his temper after everything he went through last year and he's going through this year. Maybe this is the disconnect between him and his friends. They can be there for him and believe him, but they don't fully understand what he's going through because they weren't there. So there's always a part of them that won't understand. They go into Transfiguration, and Umbridge is there to inspect the class, and McGonagall's handling of it is perfect. She's not taking any shit from Umbridge and isn't giving her an inch. And seeing her behavior toward Umbridge, Harry points out that McGonagall really shouldn't be talking to him about losing his temper with Umbridge when she's doing the same thing. But the experience is satisfying enough that he isn't mad at her about it. And there's this really fun moment where Harry gives her a smile at the end of class and she returns it. After that, Umbridge inspects Care of Magical Creatures with Professor Grubbly Plank. And we find out that Dumbledore isn't giving Umbridge any information about where Hagrid is either, which is probably a good thing. And Umbridge tries to catch Grubbly Plank out on answering negatively about Hogwarts, but she doesn't. She says Dumbledore is excellent and she's happy with how things are currently run. And she does agree that Grubbly Plank seems to know what she's talking about, but she's still on a mission to catch information about Hagrid. She asks about class injuries, and Malfoy, to no one's surprise, is quick to speak up about his experience with Buckbeak, but Harry chimes in to say that actually it's because he wasn't listening to Hagrid's instructions, which is totally true. Hagrid gave very clear instructions to the class about how they should act around these creatures, and yet Draco didn't listen. Not that it mattered in the end, since it ended up with Buckbeak being sentenced to death, another indication of the influence the Malfoys have within this society. And Harry gets another night of detention. And the end of this chapter is a pretty big moment. Hermione talks about how they're not going to learn anything in Umbridge's class, and they need to do something about it. And she suggests that Harry teach them Defense Against the Dark Arts this year. And what's interesting here is that when Harry arrived at Grimmauld Place, he spoke about all the things he's done. And he did that to lay out his case as to why he should be trusted with the information Hermione and Ron were privy to over the summer. But now he's making excuses for all of the things he's done. He talks about how the first year wasn't skill, that he had help in year two, that the time turner was responsible for his actions in book three. He talks about how really all of these things were a combination of luck and help from somebody else. He didn't plan his way through these things, he just winged it, which to me seems even more impressive. And then he finally not breaks down, but breaks out his argument with them, that neither of them know what it's like. They haven't had to face Voldemort. It's not about memorizing spells and throwing them at a target. That's the big piece that's missing from classes. The fact that in those moments, there are no do-overs, there's just you and your skills and what you can think of in the moment. And he talks about how Cedric didn't mess up. It's not that he didn't know enough. It could have easily been Harry in Cedric's position. It's so much different than what they think it is. And yet that's why they need him. That's why they need him to teach them Defense Against the Dark Arts, because they don't know what it's like. And they'll never stand a chance without the ability to use these spells that Umbridge is trying to prevent them from learning. They ask him to think about it, And this chapter ends with Harry dreaming of the corridor again and his scar prickling when he wakes up. So what do you think about everything in these chapters? What do you think of Hermione's idea of Harry teaching Defense Against the Dark Arts? What do you think is the significance of Harry backtracking on everything he's done? Let me know all of your thoughts on these two chapters at firstyearspodcast@gmail.com. You can also find me on Instagram and Twitter at firstyearspod. Please don't forget that you can earn house points by participating in Mindful Magic Monday or our trivia in our Instagram stories on Wednesdays. Also, if you rate and review and leave your name in Hogwarts House, you'll get a special shout out on here as well as bonus house points. For next episode, you need to read chapters 16 and 17, and I will see you guys next time. First Years is a production of Matchbook. It's produced by Quinn Parker and myself, Sarah Jones-Dittmeyer. All sources can be found in our show notes or on our website at authorsarahjonesdittmeyer.info/firstyearspodcast. That's Sarah with an H, and Dittmeyer is spelled Dittmeier. Please remember that staying a Harry Potter fan is the biggest form of revolt that you can have, and we are committed to continuing to make this fandom and this community safe and welcoming to everybody.